And I'd like to get the meeting started and call to order. Thank you very much for taking time out of your busy day to come and attend the meeting, and thank you to all the committee members for being here today. I would just like to start off with just a brief moment of silence and recognition for the tragedy in Las Vegas, for all the people that helped, from lay citizens to physicians and everybody in between, and EMS and police and the public of trying to help during the shooting. One of my pediatricians at Mission Hospital, or Children's at Mission, her husband was there and got shot in the leg. Unfortunately, it was a superficial wound and didn't even realize he was shot as they were running out. But when they got back to the hotel, she said, "Your pants got ripped. What happened?" And then they looked, and there was literally a slug, like, right in his skin there that they were able to just pull out with their finger. And, you know, there was so much excitement, they didn't even realize that had happened. But, you know, there's going to be so many stories like that, so much tragedy. So I'd like to acknowledge everybody that helped there to not make it worse and give it a minute. I think a quote from Abraham Lincoln is perfect when he was talking about the darkest moments of the Civil War. He said, "Behind the clouds, the sun always shines." So, you know, that's something to remember, that there are dark days and tragedies, but the sun will rise again. With that, I'd like to introduce some new appointments. First is Arthur Pedroza from the Board of Supervisors in the 1st District. And Art, if you'd like to just take a few seconds to tell us about yourself, and I'd like to welcome you to the committee.
Thank you for the nice welcome. Great to be here representing Supervisor Doe. I've been working in occupational safety for about 20 years, including 10 years in risk control for an insurance carrier. Member of the Santa Ana Community Emergency Response Team, been teaching first aid and CPR for almost 15 years, and really looking forward to participating in this commission.
Thank you very much. And then my reappointment was approved. It was funny, though. They called me and said, "You're not registered to vote." And I said, "Well, I voted in the last election. What are you talking about?" And then they had my name mixed up with somebody else, so I cleared the background check. Next,
I have one announcement.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. One more announcement. Sorry, go ahead.
And then one other announcement that's not on the agenda is that EMS is happy to announce that Dr. Carl Schultz is coming on board the end of next week, actually, as our associate medical director for EMS. Carl's a emergency physician on the faculty at UC Irvine right now. And I think the easiest way to summarize why we're bringing him on is that he is the co-author of the primary textbook for disaster medicine and disaster medical sciences throughout the world. It's a textbook that he co-authors or co-edits with Christy Koenig, who's the EMS medical director now in San Diego. So Carl will be coming on, and we are looking forward. Of course, I'm really looking forward to his coming on and helping us with not just EMS, but our disaster responsibilities.
That's a very nice addition to your team. Thank you, Sam. Next, approval of the minutes. I reviewed them, and the only thing that I'd ask Sam from the previous meeting in the minutes, we had asked that on the ambulance patient offload times to APOT, that we also include the average time in addition to the 90th percentile.
Okay, yeah. I think we already have done that, but it's not in the packet, so I'll make sure that's in next time and talk to our data analyst group and make sure it's in there. So what we would do is put in, it'll be the 90th percentile, which is what the state requires, but we'll put in the average per facility with the standard deviations for those that are used to normal statistical analysis.
Good. If there's no opposition, I would make a recommendation we approve the minutes. Great. That's a nice parliamentary way to approve motions and things. If there's no opposition, it just speeds things along rather than a first and a second. Next, OCMS report and correspondence. Sam, medical director's report.
Yeah, I'll start with the medical director's report. Really, two things. One is we have recently done a biannual update of our standing orders and our medical procedures. Those have been implemented as of October 1st So that's rolling along with revisions, and that's throughout the system. That involves around 6,000 EMTs and around 1,000 paramedics and 500 base hospital MICNs. The second thing's a little more, you know, I'd be happy to answer questions on either one, but the second one's a little more, I think, interesting. I believe that most people are aware that there's a hepatitis A outbreak that's occurred in San Diego, primarily among those that are homeless. And there's been quite a bit of effort in San Diego with distributing and administering hepatitis A vaccine to the homeless and healthcare providers and others. And in San Diego, there are recommendations that hepatitis A vaccine be made available through emergency departments. And that's through their, at the recommendation of their health officer. The same thing in Los Angeles. There's a push to make hepatitis A available in emergency departments and to vaccinate the staff of emergency departments in Los Angeles. In Orange County, in LA's had, I don't know what their number is, but they have some cases connected with the San Diego outbreak. Orange County's had two cases of Hep A reported since all of this began, one in a homeless person and one in someone, a woman in her 70s who has actually a nice home. Both those cases with DNA, RNA testing were associated with San Diego. But at this point, our epidemiology department is only recommending that the CDC guidelines be followed, which is not a the CDC does not recommend in an area that's without an outbreak, which Orange County is not in an official outbreak. Anyway, there's not a recommendation for mass vaccination, but our epidemiology department is recommending that Hep A vaccinations be made available to healthcare providers. We've discussed it with the fire departments yesterday. Have not yet discussed it with the ambulance companies, and we're leaving it up to the hospital. So right now, to summarize, there's not per epidemiology at the healthcare agency a hepatitis A outbreak in Orange County. It's being monitored day by day. And there currently is no change from usual practice, if you will, with regard to Hep A vaccinations, other than recommending it to those that wish to be covered that are potentially in contact with high-risk groups. So I can answer any questions on that if there are any. I guess one other point about it is most of those who's in the generation who still have hair on their heads when they're male are being vaccinated. It's become a required vaccine in not required, but you can opt out, but it's a vaccine like the other vaccines for attendance at school. So we're primarily talking about the generations past age 22, I believe. I think that's it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Next, 911 emergency ambulance transport contracts performance annual report.
And Adrian's going to do that for us.
Oh, great. Thanks, Adrian.
Hi. I'd like to report or to inform you that the 2016-2017 annual report has come out, and that starts on page... I believe it's 10 of the packet that you have there. And I'd also like to inform you that all monthly response time compliance for all geographical ambulance response zones for the 2016-2017 annual report exceeded the 90th percentile standard set forth by the contract. And that's it.
Thank you.
Welcome.
That's outstanding. Next, Orange County Hospital Diversion Report, January 1st to September 30th, 2017.
And Mike DeLobby is going to handle that for us.
Good morning, committee members. In attachment 3 of your packet, you'll find the diversion report, as Dr. Ritter said, January through September of this year. And I'll run through a few of the pages just to orient you to each category. So page 39, 40, and 41 are areas of hospitals that have percent of diversion for emergency department diversion time reported. So it's reported as percent of time month over month for January to September. Page 42 of that report is the same documentation, emergency department diversion, but it's reported in hours. So a little different perspective instead of percent of time. Page 43 shows a cumulative total month over month, year over year from 2012 to current date. So you can compare historical trends to what's going on now. Overall emergency department diversions down this year from previous years, so that's a good thing. Page 44, trauma receiving center diversion is reported in percent of time, and that remains relatively low. Page 45 is cardiovascular receiving center percent of time on diversion. Those remain relatively low with a few isolated spikes at times. Page 46 is internal disruption diversion reported as percent of time. Again, relatively low, just a couple of incidences that have come up. And then page 47 will be CT diversion reported also in percent of time. And that's the diversion report January through September.
Thanks, Mike. Next, Orange County EMCC annual report. This is the attachment number 4.
And Tammy's gonna.
Good morning, Tammy McConnell, EMS Administrator. The as required by Health and Safety Code, we have compiled a fiscal year 16-17 annual report of the EMCC committee activities and actions. This is a compilation from July 16 up through our last meeting, and it is gets submitted to the state on an annual basis. It is a very brief summary of the activities that have been discussed in action items taken in this committee. So it's just for review and file.
Great, thank you. Next, EMCC correspondence. We have one letter attached in the packet. I believe this is the only one from. This is from Stephen Wontrowski. And Stephen here at the meeting? No.
He may come in later.
Okay, we can hold this if he wants to speak to it, if he comes in later. Next, we go to the advisory subcommittee and advisory group reports.
So, let's see. Jim, I'm going to ask you to do transportation, and then I'll cover the others. Is that okay?
Yeah, happy to. We have our next meeting set here for, I believe it's October 25th, and the committee is functioning well. I don't really have much from our last meeting, but the minutes are available on the website for that.
Thank you.
And then facilities met July 11th, so that was right after our last meeting. And there was primarily a discussion on the ambulance patient offload time and diversion and how that's calculated and what the average should be for Orange County or what the accepted ambulance patient offload time should be or the target. Also discussed was our EMS's newer emergency receiving center designation process. It's moved from primarily a paper-based format to an online format to decrease time and basically paper and mailing that is needed when we redesignate emergency receiving centers as well as specialty centers. And so that was facilities. Education and training met earlier this week and accepted, reviewed, and we are already within that committee placing new members based on the discussion held at this here at the EMCC last time with an adoption of the membership representation list that was recommended from EMCC. And then the County Paramedic Advisory Committee met, I believe it was about a week and a half ago. Primarily, one of the main things discussed there were the drug shortages that we keep having occur, not just in Orange County, but throughout the United States. Some of the medications that are key medications, epinephrine, for example, in EMS, they're key for practice of EMS, or in short supply. So we discussed that issue and what could be done. It's controversial, but since last June, we, under direction from EMS, have a policy, not a policy, but a procedure in place that allows for extending the expired, the expiration date of drugs that are used in EMS. All of them, we use drugs, for example, one called amiodarone that could degradate in heat or in the back of an ambulance, epinephrine, and other drugs. All of those have really either been looked at by studies to determine how stable they are in ambulances, or there's been contact made up and down the state, including here in Orange County, with the manufacturers to determine the risk of extending the expiration date beyond that that's printed on the medication itself or its container. So we currently, based on the fact that we've got no negative, if you will, feedback about extending expiration dates, currently allow for extension of expiration dates. And I think the most important thing for this committee to know, and that needs to be in the minutes for all the different representative groups in the county, is that if we do administer a expired drug under this extension procedure that we have in place, EMS is to be notified, and then the patient or their family will be contacted by EMS with an explanation of why we used an expired drug for their care in the field. And it's usually going to be there was no other option. And as I just said, we've looked at the stability of the drugs and all, and we feel it's better than with not having anything. So we will contact any person who receives an expired drug once we're notified so that they're aware of what happened and why it happened. So I can answer any questions on that. And you can imagine that was quite a discussion at that meeting. Okay.
Dr. Stratton, sorry. So I know that the hospitals are experiencing these same things. And we have followed the guidelines that our pharmacy department has given us and gone back to a certain date, and only for, I think it's like a 6-month period from that date backwards. But we're, as a hospitals, I don't believe, are reporting that to patients and families if an expired medication is given. And it's usually, these are the emergency resuscitation medications that are usually the ones.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah, we, I understand that, and it, I guess it's a philosophical debate that goes on. Some of the EMS systems in the state are not notifying patients and families. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the norm is to notify in EMS, not in hospitals.
Okay. I was just wondering if that should be implemented at hospitals as well, and I don't know how we would monitor that, but...
I don't know.
And it probably would not be under the purview of this committee mandate, something like that. But I do think it's an interesting point that we could take back to our respective institutions.
Correct, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. I guess it's based on the premise that medical error should be, a patient should be notified of a medical error. And even though it's not a medical error, it's a medical ethics issue, I guess, as much as anything. So we're trying to take at least an EMS, because this is, it's not just an individual healthcare deliverer relationship, it's a community relationship to an individual. We're trying to take a higher, stand on it.
Great, thank you. Anything else from CPAC or Transportation Subcommittee?
We are, and it's Dr. Annis is not here, but based on his discussion last time at this meeting in some other issues that have come up on the trauma side of things, we are working with Children's Hospital to begin to develop a pediatric resource advisory system to EMS. And they, of course, would be able to answer, or we would be able to forward any pediatric-related questions from this committee to this group to give us advice one way or the other. But we, another one, just so everyone's aware, we are working with CHOC to develop a what we call a pediatric resource center. And then as other comprehensive pediatric centers come up, they would also be included in a group that we would use as a resource, not just for policies and procedures in EMS, but for various committees. And also based on Dr. Annis's recommendation, we're putting a pediatric representative on the education and training subcommittee.
Oh, great. It'll be nice to have their input. Thank you. Anything else, Sam?
That should do it.
So next, unfinished business, ambulance patient offload times, which is attachment number 6 in your packet.
Yeah, this committee had already delegated to the facilities committee the task of determining what should be the standard in Orange County. And they are still working on that. So it looks like, in our data, it looks like 30 minutes should be around the 30 minutes, 90% of the time should be that should be the definite cutoff for anything over that being really something, a red light, if you will. But that's just our own internal work that we'll present more and discuss with
Do you know what happens in to these kind of times for counties that have no diversion, so they're not allowed to go on diversion? Do these times go up significantly when that?
So what Dr. Ritter's bringing up is that there, among emergency medicine specialists, there's a feeling that if you have a no diversion policy in your emergency department, the likelihood of ambulance patient offload time would go up. So they're countering each other constantly. We don't know one way or the other whether that's really true. It's a prevalent belief in emergency medicine. Our ambulance patient offload time is more validated, because we've only been collecting it since the beginning of the year. Once it's validated, we'd have the data to look at that in this county, because we have robust data with regard to diversion, and would have then also valid data to compare. So it's an interesting thing we'll be able to look at.
Oh, good, good. Maybe give us an update on the future on that.
Just one comment. It does make sense for these times to be referred to facilities. It's that constituency group that has the major control on making improvements here. But I do think that because of its high impact on transportation, before we come to set numbers, that maybe Transpo should also have some comment on it back to the EMCC.
Sure, I think that's reasonable. Any other questions or comments on the offload times? Next, Orange County Drowning Prevention Report.
Yeah, that's, I think it's attachment 7. At the last meeting, which was in July, there, in fact, I think the weekend before the meeting, there had been reported 5 drownings in the county. There was interest in knowing what's being done in the county to prevent drownings. There is a drowning prevention task force, and it's page 59 begins the report. The 2016 drowning prevention report is in the packet. They're currently preparing the 2017 drowning report, and it goes through the different, on page 61, really goes through the different public health messaging procedures and processes that have been pursued, followed, and completed with the by the drowning prevention task force. I think also, if you look on page 60, it's interesting. There are a number of cities that, in fact, are contributing funds to that task force to help support their efforts, and those are listed on page 60. So I think we can just enter that into the minutes unless there are any questions.
No, that was great.
Just a question on this evaluation report. Do they ever compare? Well, I just want to assess when the campaign actually started. So we're talking about October 2016. And until October 2017. So the campaign's only gone on for 1 year. It didn't go on the year previously?
Correct.
Okay.
The Drowning Prevention Task Force was organized the year before, and it was at the direction of the Board of Supervisors. So this is their first year report.
First year campaign.
So I think you're going to ask, I'm going to anticipate that you're asking, can we see the results?
Right. I was thinking about comparisons because I did hear about the task force previously, but it makes sense if they got started but just implemented the campaign last year and we're just seeing 1 year of results. So I guess at some point I'd like to see the difference in the outreach results and how, you know, they're learning from best practices and increasing the outreach and the number of impressions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll, I don't know that we need to keep it on, I'll make sure that we keep it on the agenda next summer when it, obviously, the drowning spike up again.
Thank you. Next, new business. These are informational items. The EMS plan annual update. Any comments on that or just informational?
Yeah, Tammy's got
it. It's just informational. This is attachment 8 starting on page 62. And every year we're required to submit an annual update of our EMS plan. Our EMS plan that was done, submitted, and approved in 2014 had several objectives listed regarding some of the standards. So every year we have to provide our where we are with those, where our progress level is for those objectives. It also contains updated information for ambulance providers, dispatch centers, fire agencies, and hospitals. And so it'll be submitted to the state later this month.
Great. Thank you for putting this together. It looks like a lot of work. Next, Orange County Point of Dispensing, the pod.
Do you mind introducing Allison? No. Yes, Tammy will introduce.
So I think at the last meeting I mentioned that the EMS agency had a reorganization. And in this case, it was a great reorganization because what it did was merge our health disaster management section into EMS. Health disaster management has been around for over a decade, and they're responsible for health disaster planning, training and exercising, and making sure that the healthcare agency and the medical and health community, which isn't just hospitals, it's also clinics, long-term cares, making sure that they are prepared and capable of responding to emergencies and disasters. So having this section within EMS truly complements both of our mission statements. Today, I invited Allison Kelman, who is a program supervisor in HDM, and she's responsible for the point of dispensing program. And I asked her to come up and do a brief presentation on that. It's timely because we have the point of dispensing is also known as POD. I don't want to steal her thunder, but it's timely since we have we are going to be exercising pods in two cities. So I give the floor to Allison Kelman.
Good morning. The video that you will see today, the point of dispensing, or POD as we call it, introduction and overview, reviews the Orange County Healthcare Agency's point of dispensing process in detail to include staff functions, public processes, documentation, safety, policies and procedures, just general procedures of how we get people from point A to B in a POD site. The video provides an overview of what you can expect to see, or if you participate in, our point of dispensing exercise on Thursday, October the 26th. We will be exercising in the city of Tustin and in the city of Westminster. We are prepared to administer 620 influenza vaccines, with 20 of those being for pregnant women. The city of Westminster will exercise walkthrough processes, while the city of Tustin will exercise walkthrough and drive-through processes. This year, we coordinated with 5 nursing schools who will also participate in dispensing and other modalities during the exercise. We also coordinated with Ready OC, who provided 300 emergency preparedness buckets for attendees that day. The Orange County Healthcare Agency has implemented this process since 2006, and we are required to have 78 POD sites. This is a formula based on population, and we have currently 72 POD sites. To date, we have planned with 30 of 34 cities, and we're looking forward to planning with, in the near future, San Clemente, Los Alamitos, Costa Mesa, and La Palma. And 2 other associated processes are first responder pods, where we are working towards plans on pre-positioning medication, and also business pods, where we work with businesses who have over 1,000 employees, and we push the medication out to them. Well, actually, they pick up and dispense to their employees. So with that, I'd like you to watch the video and you get an idea of some of the things I've shared with you.
Whether man-made or by natural, they pose a threat to our health and well-being. In response to these emergencies, the Orange County Healthcare Agency, in cooperation with county and local city officials, has developed a strategy to rapidly dispense protective measures. We call this strategy point of dispensing, or POD for short. A POD site is a location within a city or community that has been planned in advance as a means to quickly dispense much-needed medications, vaccinations, and medical supplies to Orange County residents, employers, and visitors during a health emergency. Today, we'll look at what a POD is, review its structure, and illustrate the functions it performs. Every POD site has one primary goal. PODs are used to provide protective medicines or medical supplies to the healthy community prior to the onset of illness. The more people we reach in the shortest amount of time, the more lives we save. There are 4 fundamental functions or steps to a POD: check-in, screening, dispensing, and exit. When visitors arrive at a POD site, they'll first go through the process of check-in. Here they're given information about the disease agent they may have been exposed to and the medication or vaccine they'll be receiving. They'll complete a medical history form to collect basic health history information and list any potential allergies. The next step is the screening process.
Completed forms are reviewed for any allergy information, possible reactions, and other things that might lower the effectiveness of the medication or vaccine. If no issues are identified, visitors proceed to the next step. The third function of the pod is the dispensing area. Here, visitors receive the medications, vaccines, or medical supplies. Some scenarios call for pill dispensing. Other situations may require vaccine injections. If the pod is dispensing medications in injection form, these will be conducted by licensed medical personnel. The fourth and final step at every pod site is the exit station. The exit station will collect the medical history forms and answer any questions. Depending upon the number of people projected to visit a pod, each site may be structured as either a walk-through or a drive-through pod, or even a combination of both. At a drive-through pod, visitors remain in their vehicles throughout the process.
You are welcome.
As you can see, the process at every pod site is meant to be fast and simple, while adaptable to almost any situation. Every pod site is organized with a similar structure, even though the physical location will differ from pod site to pod site. A pod site can be divided into four separate sections of responsibility. These are command, operations, logistics, and planning. Each section is identified by the color vest staff members wear. The command section has the overall responsibility for managing the pod site. The command staff wear yellow vests. At the head is the Unified Command, so named because they are comprised of members from the Orange County Healthcare Agency, local fire personnel, and local law enforcement representatives. They establish the objectives for the pod and oversee its operation. Also on the command staff are a safety officer who ensures the pod operates safely, a community liaison officer who interacts with outside agencies, and a public information officer who handles media inquiries. The operations section consists of three response areas: the clinic branch, the medical branch, and the security branch. Operations staff wear red vests. The clinic branch has the responsibility for check-in, screening, dispensing of medications, and collection of forms. The medical branch provides critical medical expertise and support throughout the pod site, as well as assessments and consultation as needed. The security branch controls traffic flow, provides perimeter and internal site security, and safeguards the medications while also ensuring the safety of all pod staff and the public. The logistics section, noted by their orange vests, is responsible for setting up the pod site. They oversee all facility and personnel needs while coordinating the communication equipment at the pod site. A pharmacy and supply area are also part of logistics, with staff responsible for managing the stockpile of medications, medical supplies, and general equipment. Additionally, logistics ensures all staff are provided with food and water during the operation. The planning section, in blue vests, maintains all documentation and reports the progress of pod operations to the command staff and the section chiefs. They monitor all requests for additional staffing and supply needs. Planning is also responsible for maintaining the incident action plan for the pod. The incident action plan is the primary guiding document for every pod site and enables the pod to adjust to changing conditions and needs. Once the pod response has come to an end, the planning section ensures that the site is returned back to normal. As a volunteer responding to a pod site, you play a critical role. A pod can save and protect thousands of lives. Here is some basic information you'll need to know when reporting to a pod site. Every pod site has a designated staff parking and registration area. Upon notification and assignment, you'll be provided with the staff parking location for your pod site. Upon arrival, report directly to the staff registration area to receive your position assignment, your response vest, and your reporting location. You'll also receive critical information, including a map of the pod site, a pod quick reference guide, a positions checklist that outlines your duties, and other instructions. Be sure to always wear your vest when working at a pod site. You may also be provided a communication device, such as a radio. You'll receive instruction in its use, as well as proper radio protocol. A briefing will be provided to you by your supervisor to outline your duties and review your assignment. A general briefing for all pod staff may also be held prior to operations. These briefings will include a situation update, site safety information, and instructions for requesting supplies.
You notify your supervisors.
Briefings are our primary method of communication during a pod activity. For more information on what is involved with delivering a briefing, please view the management video for supervisors. Your shift may last up to 12 hours. During that time, breaks, along with food and water, will be provided. Be sure to bring any special dietary foods or prescription medications you require during your shift. Remember that for any issues or questions that may arise, your supervisor is there to provide guidance and assistance. There may be hundreds of people moving about the pod site at any given time, and the potential for accidents or injury is always present. For personnel assigned to the drive-through clinic branch in particular, staff should have visitors put their cars in park before walking in front of vehicles and throughout moving traffic. Staff must also inform visitors to remain in their vehicles at all times. Staff should also wear proper protective equipment as directed in HCA clinic policies. Any injuries must be reported to your supervisor and to the safety officer. For all pod staff, there are several documents that are critical during a pod response. These documents create a permanent record of all activities that occurred during a pod response. You should be familiar with the following key documents and forms. The HCA Pod Field Operations Guide, or FOG, is a response document designed to be utilized in the event of a pod site activation. The FOG contains a copy of the Pod Site Incident Action Plan, position-specific forms, briefing outlines, and policies and procedures. The Incident Action Plan, or IAP, contains the guiding documents for each pod site. From pod activation through demobilization, the IAP will help drive current actions. The message form is used for all formal communications. This includes questions up the chain of command and requests for resources. The formal response to all messages will also be provided on this form. This training program contains further instructions on the positions and duties within a pod. Take time to review the section and other videos that are appropriate for your position. Be sure to learn and understand your responsibilities so that you can perform them to the best of your ability. And thank you for offering your time and efforts to ensure the health and well-being of the residents, employers, and visitors of Orange County.
Thank you. As you can see, there's many moving parts, a lot of components involved, and it takes more than a year to plan with individual cities. But in this effort, we're able to keep Orange County safe. As you know, plans always look good on paper. So that's why we take those paper plans and we implement them and see things and see how we can improve areas for our appointed dispensing sites. Do you have any questions for me?
So besides flu vaccinations, have you done any other clinics with this?
Not at the community pods.
Okay.
With our business pods, we've exercised some processes with them. It's a little different as they are the lead on their plans because they know their businesses. We set up a structure where they come and pick up from us.
Okay.
So in the community, just the flu vaccine, because we know people will come.
Right. No, that's great. Thank you.
Thanks for this informative video. The Tustin City Council, we just approved this at our last meeting, and I was curious about how everything would work out.
Right.
I had a question about outreach and how we would get the word out. with everything going on in the country, I think people are particularly interested in how their city will respond to an emergency in that time. So I think we'll have a lot of people come out if they know about it. So I wanted to know, is HCA helping the cities that they're working with to get the word out and spread outreach?
Absolutely. We've developed flyers. We've upgraded our flyers, actually. We have new public information support, and they thought that our flyers from previous years needed a facelift, so we implemented that. We have Facebook, social media accounts where we've pushed out that way. We've done outreach, just, I guess, street outreach, where we've put flyers where people will see them. We've also worked with the cities to push out in the community as well, because they know where to reach the people as well. So we're very appreciative for Tustin for stepping up this year. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much. That was great. Good job.
So how do you recruit for volunteers for administering the vaccines?
We've worked with 6 Orange County nursing schools for the past at least 7 to 8 years, actually. And so we are never at a loss for students being willing to vaccinate the public. In addition to that, we have students that work in our logistics section, so they don't just dispense. They're willing to work as exit staff to help us do time study components. And this year, we've implemented a process to have the students walk through as members of the public. We've seen a decline in people coming to the pod sites, and that's because other places incentivize the process by giving out gift cards, and we can't do that. And also, people are no longer concerned about things like H1N1. So we want to still practice this process and make it useful for everyone involved. So we have students this year coming through and rotating through the process as members of the public. And where they see gaps, they will note that, and we'll be able to put that in our after action report.
Great, thank you. Any other comments or questions?
We heard earlier about the Hep A outbreak in San Diego. If something like that happened here, would this model be applicable for a Hep A pod?
The pod process is an all-hazards approach, so we can use this for dispensing vaccine, we can use it for dispensing pills, and we can use it for dispensing items. So if we needed to dispense anything, we can use the same process. And then the process will either widen or constrict depending on what we're dispensing and what we need.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Now, under new business, Sam, could you just give us a brief update? We've had a lot of disasters recently, hurricanes, Mexico City earthquake, the Vegas shooting.
So, I should have had that on the agenda. So we have the hurricanes that are hitting the Caribbean and the East Coast. Our chief pharmacist, as well as some other CA1 California DMAT teams, actually they're federalized DMAT teams, have been deployed already and come back home from Hurricane Harvey. So we have had some interaction there. Currently, our DMAT team is scheduled. Did they go out yet? They're scheduled to go any day for a 30-day deployment into Puerto Rico. So we do have some presence at these in these hurricanes and all, but otherwise we haven't received any request for example, supplies or other expertise or things like that. With respect to another problem, and that's some rather large, difficult to control forest fires in Oregon. Many of our fire departments have rotated crews up there, again, as federal assets. They've been federalized, and they've been coming back and forth. While up there, I've been in contact with Oregon EMS system, and they operate under Orange County protocols, actually, even though they're in Oregon, the paramedics and the EMTs both. So we have a presence up there. And with respect to Las Vegas, both contact has been made, and it's by email because obviously they're quite busy with both the University Hospital and Sunrise. with their ED groups and their EMS people, and currently we have not had any request for a presence in Las Vegas. The interesting thing about Las Vegas is that they have asked that if we find out if we hear of anyone who was injured and left the scene without medical care, that they contact, and there's a the Las Vegas Police Department has a website up for contact to report that injury, for example, a flesh wound or something, or a sprained ankle. And I believe that is important for them because that will help them then define essentially federal aid requests and things like that. I had heard late yesterday, but I haven't confirmed that there either was or could have been some trauma transfers into one of our trauma centers, but I have to confirm that once we get done.
So. I know that we were going to, we had agreed to take a patient.
Correct.
We also have had a number of requests admission at our trauma center from people that want follow-up for their gunshot wounds. So they were seen, treated, you know, say it's an extremity wound, but they are so overwhelmed there, they say, and they're not from the area, they don't want to wait around to be seen and follow-up. So our trauma clinic is only open one day a week, so they've opened it up multiple days this week and next week. So if you do happen to know of someone that needs follow-up for a traumatic injury, they can contact our hospital and we can get them in.
Great, great. I can answer any questions on that. We, one thing very important, we don't, a governmental agency in, as well as all our different agencies, and Jim can back can speak to this also with regard to ambulance strike teams and all. We don't just rush into an event unless we're asked to come in. So the first axiom of response is you need to be asked to come in. You don't just show up because that makes the disaster worse. So I don't know if you want to speak about the
Yeah, there's a whole coordinated process for entities that are experiencing extreme situations to access resources both regionally, intrastate, interstate, and many of our providers here have been deployed to areas throughout the country, and it's all done in an organized fashion, documented, and planned. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you very much.
Question. You know, with this tragedy, it kind of made everybody aware that anything could happen at any time, and we need to be prepared. And, you know, we have large venues like the Honda Center, Anaheim Stadium, and we're the only children's hospital in the area, but that doesn't matter when people start putting people in back of pickup trucks and they go to a hospital. And all our hospitals around will be inundated immediately with 20,000 people that run mass casualty. What would be our plan for that in a sense? Because CHOC would get adults as well. And we're not going to be able, we would triage and we would set up outside. We're not going to be able to send adult patients somewhere else. We're going to need to treat them. And of course, My people are like, what do we do? You know, because
they're
just
big kids.
Yes, exactly, right? Parts of parts, just bigger. But, I mean, you know, they kind of haven't thought of that, of something like that, because they haven't anticipated that.
Yeah, it's good that you brought it up, because when CHOC came up as a trauma center, a pediatric trauma center, we worked with and I have to have the staff correct me if I'm wrong, because, you know, I just sit around and drink coffee and say, let's do this, let's do that, and then real people do the real work. But when CHOC came up as a trauma center, one of the things that had to be worked out was what happens if someone, a trauma victim, so we're not talking about mass casualties,
right.
But this would apply to mass casualties. What happens if a trauma victim who's an adult shows up at CHOC by mistake, and the CHOC trauma team does have adult experience, and then there's a system to rapidly move those patients over to the St. Joe's emergency room. And not only that, the emergency medicine program between the two facilities is integrated. Mm-hmm. So The plan, it would be to move the adult victims over as quickly as possible, by the way, so we can free up pediatric beds to St. Joe's. And then backing up St. Joe's would then be UCI for major victims that need a full-on trauma center.
But what if those are maxed out when you have thousands of people? I mean, we got to think that in mm-hmm. quickly. I mean, you're not
correct.
Be able to
so
move
then,
people.
So then we need to have a surge plan, mm-hmm. Be able to surge. We probably, I'll be quite honest, we're working on that now.
Okay.
And we probably could survive, but not as well as we should. Mm-hmm. So we, in fact, that is one of the priorities with our working in, you know, within our disaster preparedness, is not only a surge plan general for hospitals, but surge plan pediatric. Mm-hmm. And we're also looking at how to communicate with at-risk groups, for particularly those that are homebound. And another one we're looking at is non-English speaking populations that we have. And how do we communicate and tell them where to go or what to do or, you know. So the answer to your question is, don't put this in the minutes, please, is no BS. We need to work on it.
Right. Right. I mean, we would do what we need to do. They'd go to the OR. They'd go to the OR from PACU. They would get transferred out. I mean, we would do what we need to do, but we need to kind of think of that probably sooner than later.
Correct. And there is a plan in place and working on it. And I'll let Tammy talk about we have an emergency operations plan, which is already worked out. But
when you have thousands of victims, there's just not the infrastructure
right.
in place.
Absolutely.
You know, you do the best that you can.
Right. But, I mean, nobody plans for anything, and then look what happens.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and a couple years ago, I don't remember what the disaster was, but we initiated, we work very closely with LA County EMS, and they have a medical alert center. Mm-hmm. And in the we had talked about, like I said, I don't remember what the disaster was, but in the event that we had an inability to either dispatch or send patients around, could we utilize the MAC mm-hmm. as a means to help
sure.
decompress hospitals, determine destinations, and then also use LA County hospitals mm-hmm. To send maybe minor injured patients? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's an option.
So I guess, you know, it takes a long time to develop the perfect plan, which as soon as you publish it is outdated. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, we all talk about if something were to happen tomorrow,
right.
there's things in our back pocket that, you know, they're not written down anywhere, but we know we can pick up the phone and call for assistance.
Right. The most recent incident I can think of is the Metro link. It was 300 patients, and we processed them, and I believe it was about an hour. So, the system does work, and we are fortunate, as Tammy and Dr. Stratton alluded to, because of our proximity to Los Angeles and the resources they've been provided from the federal government to staff up on a regional basis, we're in good shape here.
And we also have the hospital incident command system that most hospitals and our ReadyNet system that will help us communicate, and that we should never discount those two efforts as well.
Great. Thank you for that update. Any other comments or questions on that? Next public forum. Is there anybody that would like to address the committee here?
No public comments.
No public comments. Next, do any of the members have any comments? I'll take that as a no. Thank you for attending today. Our next meeting is Friday, January 5th, 2018. Thank you.